Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Rachel Miro. Coming up, we'll review this past week at the U.S. Supreme Court with our very own Scott Schaefer. And today's Latino college students don't necessarily consider themselves Chicano. That puts today's Chicano Studies departments in a curious position. Also, a new memorial aims to remind us all about a terrible plane crash 65 years ago.
My idea, as far as the inscription, is to have one leaf represent each of the 32 people. They were scattered like dry leaves.
Plus, we'll talk to an Oakland artist trying to give voice to the ghosts of the past in China.
In China, we believe if you don't give them home, they will forever be homeless, hunting, always searching for a place to settle.
It's the California Report. We begin today with the big story of the week, oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court on Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. Regardless of the specifics of the two cases, this was a big political moment for the nation, an opportunity for all of us to reflect on one of the major debates of our time.
One woman, one man, one woman, one man.
Gay, straight, black, white, marriage is a civil right. Gay, straight, black.
The California Report's Scott Schaefer was there, inside the courtroom and outside, talking to the crowds. And now he's here in the studio to share with us. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here. Hi, Rachel.
You know, Scott, there's powerful symbolism in watching the top judges of the land take up marriage and civil rights, but they were conducting legal cases, legal procedures. And this wasn't like watching Perry Mason or Atticus Finch expound before a transfixed courtroom.
It really wasn't. And, we are used to watching shows like L.A. Law. I'm dating myself now. But, you know, where the lawyers are the stars. And what you come to realize in watching these oral arguments is that the stars are really the justices. And for those who were there hoping to see some grand speeches by the attorneys on one side or the other making their point, there was a kind of a disappointment. It's a little disconcerting. And in fact, afterwards, after that first day, I was outside in front of the courtroom, and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, who kind of got the ball rolling years ago when he started issuing marriage licenses in San Francisco, I asked him, what did you think? And here's what he had to say.
I think more than anything else, it was the inability to articulate an argument. There really wasn't an opportunity to make a case. There was barely a mention, with the exception of Scalia twice in passing and sort of flippantly, a discussion about all 50 states. And to be honest with you, I was disappointed in the Solicitor General's whole argument. It was as if they weren't there. They were there tomorrow.
And I think Gavin Newsom, in some ways, Rachel, spoke for a lot of people who just felt a little disappointed, and that we think was true on both sides. They wanted their case made, the case that they believe in their heart. They wanted to hear that case made in court, and there really wasn't a chance to do that in some ways.
You know, Scott, another thing I was really struck by this week was how dramatically the conversation about gay rights has shifted in recent years. You really heard that this week, especially in the way the rhetoric has changed.
Well, especially around DOMA, because, that law goes back to 1996. And there was a real anti-gay fervor in the country at that time around gay marriage. President Clinton signed the law, and he has since repudiated that. But you heard the attorney for representing the House Republicans, who are now defending DOMA, Paul Clement, trying to say, the motivation for DOMA was really about uniformity. We wanted to treat all same-sex couples the same, no matter which states they lived in. And Elena Kagan, Justice Kagan, brought a little bit of reality into that. And let's listen to that exchange.
Well, is what happened in 1996, and I'm going to quote from the House report here, is that Congress decided to reflect and honor a collective moral judgment and to express moral disapproval of homosexuality. Is that what happened in 1996?
Does the House report say that? Of course the House report says that. And if that's enough to invalidate the statute, then you should invalidate the statute. But that's never been your approach.
and Paul Clement, they're a little exasperated because he had tried to shift it away from the moral disapproval argument, and there Kagan kind of dragged him back to the middle. But you did hear the opponents of same-sex marriage trying to soften their argument a little bit, make it sound a little bit more reasonable to fit with, as you say, these shifting standards and polls and cultural and political changes that are going on.
You were outside of the courtroom as much as you were inside it in Washington, D.C., and witness to a lot of emotional moments in that crowd. I'm wondering if you can describe one or two.
There was one which I did not expect. I was actually live on the radio with KQED doing a little debriefing, and the widow, the 83-year-old widow, Edith Windsor, who was the plaintiff in the DOMA case, was making her way down the steps of the Supreme Court, and she's a little woman. She can't be taller than 5 feet. And she was surrounded by TV cameras and microphones and adoring people just sort of thanking her for taking on this issue. And it was like a victory lap.
Given how much the politics have changed, what does that mean for the legal arguments in both the Prop 8 and the DOMA cases?
Well, on behalf of same-sex marriage, there's the point, that this whole moral disapproval isn't good enough as a reason to ban same-sex marriage, and that this is really based on discrimination, and the courts need to step in, and say that. But on the other hand, and you had Chief Justice Roberts and others saying, look, people are falling all over themselves to support your side, to say now they support same-sex marriage. Several states have voted to enact same-sex marriage. So why should the court step in now when this conversation is happening and seems to be getting resolved by people? Why should we, the judges, these unelected judges, step in and make a decision and decree what the states should do? Maybe it's time for us just to kind of step back. So that political progress that is happening and the shift that's happening, could play out either way. Both sides could use it as an argument on their behalf.
Well, we're so glad to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
That's the California Report's Scott Schaefer. He'll be back in the host chair next week. The fight over gay rights is front and center today. In many ways, it carries forward struggles that began in the 1960s. Back then, many young Mexican Americans called themselves Chicanos, raising their voices against racism. In time, they claimed a place at American universities. But that was half a century ago. Mexican-American students today don't define themselves in the same way, and Chicano studies departments are in trouble. Adrian Florido has more from San Diego.
In 1969, a group of Mexican-American academics gathered at UC Santa Barbara. They drafted a plan to begin establishing university Chicano studies departments. This was a time when Mexican-Americans were marching for political recognition across the West, like at this Vietnam War protest in Los Angeles.
We are a bronze people with a bronze culture.
They called themselves Chicanos. Today, the term commonly describes a Mexican in the U.S., but it also evokes that political movement. During civil rights, calling yourself Chicano identified you as part of the proud, sometimes even militant, struggle against second-class status.
The push for Chicano studies came from students who were involved in the Chicano movement.
Isidro Ortiz is a professor at San Diego State University's Chicano Studies Department, one of many established at California universities in the early 70s. His department flourished well into the 90s, even into the last decade. But today, things are looking different.
It's a small crisis in terms of the department's history.
Last semester, the department fell short of its enrollment target for the first time in Ortiz's memory. It's also falling short this semester, even though more than a quarter of the university's students are Latino. So Ortiz and other administrators have been trying to figure out what's going on. Why a record number of young Latinos on campus, mostly Mexican-American, hasn't translated into more students taking Chicano studies. Here's one theory.
Students, in many cases, don't identify as Chicanos, as did the generation who created this department, but rather identify as Mexicanos.
Many of the young Mexican-Americans on university campuses today are the children of the large wave of immigrants who came in the 80s and 90s, well after the Chicano movement's heyday.
I don't know. When I think of a Chicano, I picture like somebody who, you know, grew up in the streets of East L.A.
Like people say Latina, Chicana. I really don't know really even sort of the distinctions between them. So I don't know.
No, because what I think Chicano is, I think it's like people from Michoacán. And my parents are from Jalisco, so.
San Diego State students Ernesto Limon, Sandy Chavez, and Ellen Guardado, three among thousands of children of Mexican immigrants on campus.
Maybe that term is not what's appropriate for unifying a mobilization of young people in 2013.
Jorge Mariscal is a professor at UC San Diego, where he says student interest in Chicano studies is also low. The decline's not true everywhere, though. At San Diego's Mesa College, a two-year college, Chicano studies enrollment actually grew 40% between 2007 and 2011. Professor Alessandra Moctezuma says her students find a lot of relevance in Chicano courses.
So whether you identify strictly with the term or not, maybe it's not as important as understanding the import of that history and how it applies to our activism today, for example.
She does say one reason for the high enrollment may be that her students are fulfilling general education requirements before transferring to four-year campuses, where many do choose majors that prepare them for the job market, like business or biology. And that's the recruitment challenge for Chicano studies departments like San Diego State's, where Latino students are a large and growing contingent, but increasingly view themselves as part of the mainstream.
We should be in a position to be able to capitalize on those numbers.
Professor Isidro Ortiz.
And I think we will be able to, provided we can resolve this puzzle.
Ortiz says that to solve that puzzle, the department may retool its curriculum to make courses more inclusive of other Latino nationalities, or it may do what other Chicano studies departments have done and change its name. For the California Report, I'm Adrian Florido in San Diego.
65 years ago, a plane full of Mexican laborers crashed in the hills near Coalinga. At the time, the disaster grabbed national headlines and even inspired a song by Woody Guthrie. That song has since been covered by many artists, but the event itself has faded into the mists of Central Valley history. What would it take to turn that around? Valley Public Radio's Rebecca Plevin brings us this report.
Author Tim Z. Hernandez was digging through old newspapers at the Fresno County Library when a dramatic headline from the late 1940s captured his attention.
100 people see a ship plunge to the earth or something like that. It was just really a, you know, captivating headline. And I instantly realized after reading that it had to be tied into Woody Guthrie's song.
The sky plane caught fire over Los Gatos Canyon. Like a fireball of lightning, it shook all our hills. And who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves? The radio says they are just deportees.
That song, Deportee, is performed here by Arlo Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's son. The folk musician wrote the lyrics after hearing of a harrowing plane crash in Los Gatos Canyon, near the small town of Coalinga in Central California. The plane was transporting 28 Mexican nationals who were being deported. None survived the crash, and their names were not published in initial news accounts. In his song, Guthrie assigned symbolic names to the victims.
Goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos. Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. And all they will call you will be.
Author Tim Hernandez instantly knew he had another book idea. He says he wanted to give those who died some measure of dignity by learning more about them, including their real names.
I think I just felt compelled to want to find their story or put their story back.
Hernandez's goal is to reconstruct the accident and the lives of the people affected by it.
It's nice here. It's like someone's backyard. You know, it's very pretty. It's a cow field right
That's
now.
Coalinga resident Larry Hawes at the site of the crash. His mother was just a child when she saw the wing of the plane fall off and land steps from her grandmother's home.
The plane came in and barely made it over this little ridge here we see to our right. And it was spiraling and it barely made it over that and it crashed head on into this creek bank right here and it caught these three trees on fire.
Hernandez also connected with Hawes's aunt,
June Lee Austin, who was almost 10 years old when the plane crashed near her home in the canyon. The 74-year-old still recalls the gruesome details of the crash.
There were bodies scattered all over. So it took a lot to even find everybody and or all the pieces, I should say. I don't know that there were any bodies totally intact, and none were identified.
But Hernandez combed through records to properly identify all 28 of them. His search also took him to Fresno's Holy Cross Cemetery. It's there that the Mexican nationals are buried. Their graves are marked with one headstone, again, without any names.
It's a 12 by 24 bronze memorial. As you can see, it's weathered, it's patinaed. It says 28 Mexican citizens who died in an airplane accident near Coalinga, California on January 28, 1948. Rest in peace.
That's Carlos Rascon. He is the director of cemeteries for the Roman Catholic Diocese of Fresno. He and Hernandez came up with a plan. They are raising $10,000 to establish a memorial to the victims of the plane crash. It will include the names of each of the 28 Mexican citizens.
My idea as far as the inscription is to have one leaf represent each of the 32 people. 28 of them are here, but the other four were buried elsewhere. And if you hear Woody Guthrie's poem, it says that they were scattered like dry leaves on our topsoil.
Is this the best way we can grow our big orchards? Is this the best way we can grow our good fruit? To fold like dry leaves and to rot on your topsoil.
Author Tim Hernandez.
We want the community to feel that this is part of their history as well. Not just California history, but, you know, American history, as Woody Guthrie sort of told us. And at the end of the day, I mean, our names are really what we have.
Mi amigos, Jesus y Maria, you won't have a name when you ride the big airplane. And all they will call you will be deportee.
The crash victims will be honored on Labor Day when the new headstone is erected. Hernandez's book should be released next summer. For the California Report, I'm Rebecca Plevin in Coalinga.
Rebecca Plevin brought a camera with her to Coalinga. You can see her photos at californiareport.org. California has long been a draw for musicians like Jenny O. Originally from Long Island, she calls Los Angeles home now, so much so she expresses nostalgia for L.A.'s musical history in her own work. The California Report's pop music critic Steve Hockman reviews her debut album, Auto Mechanic.
A few years ago, Jenny O. decided that she needed to know how to fix cars, so she taught herself. And now, in addition to a vocation, it's provided the title and title song of her debut album. But Auto Mechanic is a look under the emotional hood.
I had a similar dream. My dream was real, though. I left my body in the bed. I took my clutch and pipe, climbed out the
Zen and the Art of Auto Maintenance? Pretty much. Solitary tinkering for inner peace, whether the engine is real or metaphorical. It's with the album's second song, though, that she elaborates her declaration of who she is, or at least who she is not. She's not a cheerleader, she sings at the start of Lazy Jane. She's not a true believer. She just doesn't have that inner.
And so
yeah, well, don't buy the loner act entirely. That's clear when you see her on stage, a gregarious, cheerful host, a team player with her band. An auto mechanic puts her squarely in the middle of a thriving community and a venerable tradition of California musicians mixing country and folk earnestness, refined pop craft, and rock and roll heart alongside such earthy buzz acts as Dawes and Father John Misty. It's no coincidence that she worked with their producer, Jonathan Wilson, who brings in sensibilities evolved from his vaunted love for the old Laurel Canyon scene. There's even a sitar in Come Get Me. Other echoes of the past pop up here and there. Lazy Jane, as you heard, recalls Stevie Nicks. And the song Learn My Lessons brings Simon & Garfunkel's 59th Street Bridge song to mind. You know, the one subtitled Feelin' Groovy. So yeah, she does a little kicking down those cobblestones of the past. But there's a real present tense in her wistfulness, her nostalgia being not so much cultural as it is personal. A couple of years ago, Jenny, who grew up on Long Island with the full name Jenny Onyebene, burst out with her first single, Well Okay Honey, a perfect summer song that promised much sunshine to come. There's plenty of light here, but it's muted into a variety of hues. One song, Opposite Island, sounds more like a moonlit midwinter night.
It's safe to say it's bad news.
It all makes for a richer, involving collection. And with such songs as Good Love, her pulsating fingerpicking and funk and pop veteran James Gadsden's drumming driving it along, everything for Jenny O seems to be purring like a freshly tuned engine in the hands of a fine mechanic.
Steve Hochman is a Los Angeles-based writer who covers pop music for the California Report. He reviewed Auto Mechanic by Jenny O. In this week's show, we've been talking a lot about history and memory. In this next story, we'll meet an artist whose work plays heavily on those themes. Chinese-born Hung Lu's work incorporates both Chinese history and her own personal history in China. Now, the first comprehensive survey of her art is on display at the Oakland Museum of California, the first stop on a national tour. KQED's Cy Musiker has more on the exhibition called Summoning Ghosts.
The ghosts Hung Lu summons are the people in her paintings and sculptures, sometimes family members, but also students and soldiers, peasants, prostitutes, and others out of her and China's past. Rene de Guzman is chief curator at the Oakland Museum of California, and he put together Lu's show with this core idea in mind.
Which is to look at the relationship between memory and history.
Personal and political history. Lu never knew her father, imprisoned because he fought against the communist revolution.
She's had this sort of critical view of communist idealism and the realities that really happened. For instance, she lived through the Great Leap Forward when China had this plan to industrialize itself.
Which ended in economic disaster. But that period also produced Lu's first artwork.
This is the sketch that Hung did when she was 5 years old. For some reason, her mother miraculously saved it. Well, maybe that's not so unusual because all our mothers save all our drawings. But what's unusual about this is, you know, as a 5-year-old girl, she was already documenting the national history of China.
For Hung Lu, the sketch is a time machine, taking her back to October 1st, 1953.
Which was a Chinese national day. It's like a 4th of July here. So I did the people with the little banners and Mao Zedong's portraits on the street.
We're at Hung Lu's roomy studio now in East Oakland. Lu is 65 and busier than ever. She's working this day on four huge canvases lined up along one wall. They're based on photos chronicling her grandfather's research in the 1920s on a mountain in Manchuria with religious significance.
My grandfather taught biology. He loves flowers.
Oh, he's holding flowers.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. A branch of flowers.
Well, look, are these the photographs that inspired these pictures?
Here. Yeah. This is him.
See, Lu often works from photos in a realistic style, so her grandfather, his walking stick, and the monks he studied are vividly alive on the canvas. But she's no documentarian, and her paintings and sculptures include surreal touches and layers of meaning. Butterflies and birds dart across her canvases, and she often drips linseed oil and smears the image to show how memory blurs history. The technique is also a tribute to an ancient style of Chinese painting and a kind of revenge to socialist realism, that rigidly uplifting style glorifying the working class.
For me, it's fascinating that you can be little unreasonable, illogical, and can turn things upside down, inside out, and could be 100 years apart. But that's art making.
Lu trained as a photographer and muralist in China. There, the rules were brutally logical. Lu was attacked, for instance, for including an outhouse in an impressionist landscape.
There's a party member. Her nickname in my class, nickname is government. She said, how could you, what kind of conscious political stand you take to do a public toilet? How could you?
Lu says for her, the message from that exchange was clear.
There's no middle ground. If you apolitical, you in the enemy side. After that, I have to be very careful. Didn't stop me from doing it.
But it intensified her desire to come to the U.S., which she did in 1986 with $20 in her pocket. The Oakland show includes the outhouse painting and other early work Lu kept hidden. And there's a series of richly decorated paintings based on 19th century photos of Chinese prostitutes, a series that embodies the show's title, Summoning Ghosts.
I feel their ghost spirit around. In China, we believe if you don't give them home, they were forever being homeless, hunting, always searching for a place to settle those ghosts. So I feel in the spirit of calling them home. So my paintings become a memorial site.
Summoning Ghosts, the Art of Hung Lu, continues at the Oakland Museum through June before embarking on a 2-year national tour. The San Jose Museum of Art will mount a show of new work by Lu in June. For the California Report, I'm Cy Musiker.
You can see some of Hung Lu's art featured in Summoning Ghosts at californiareport.org. To dream of ghosts, you have to sleep, and there are so many things that conspire to keep us from sleeping. Noise from the neighbors, the beckoning glow of your smartphone, worry about work. We're devoting a whole show to sleep on April 12th, and we want to know whether you saw logs all night or toss and turn till the birds wake up. Email us at calreport@kqed.org. And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. We're on Facebook, too. Like us. Please like us. Also, I am so close to 800 followers on Twitter. Won't you follow me, too? Search for my handle, Rachel Miro. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Maserati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Victoria Malion, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, Bruce Kuhn, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation. With nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards available at www.irvine.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens with prevention at calendow.org.